Hey guys, in this episode, I sat down with Justin Bogard and got a chance to talk with him. He's a mortgage note investor like I am. He runs a note fund and he focuses on seller financed notes. We talk a lot about relationship challenges and some personal, you know, family challenges and divorce that he's been through, which unfortunately is very relatable for a lot of people. And then we also talk about some instances where he's lost a good bit of money in real estate transactions and the lessons he's learned from that. We talk about how the discipline and other principles he's gathered from his background in athletics as well, and talk about, you know, the importance of structure and communication. With that said, we also discuss how he's never going back to what he refers to as W-2 jail. So I think, you know, because he puts this discipline and structure in place, that enables him to have freedom and go play golf when he wants to and go to his daughter's events when he wants to and that kind of thing. So it's a really relatable episode. We talk a lot about family and work-life balance and things that I think, you know, if you're on the edge about becoming an entrepreneur or becoming an investor, specifically with regard to real estate and mortgage notes, this episode is one you're not going to want to miss.
From adversity to abundance, hosted by entrepreneur and seasoned real estate investor Jamie Bateman, is the ultimate guide for active and passive investors seeking clarity, mental fitness, and the confidence to make inspired decisions in the world of real estate. With a decade plus of investing experience across various niches and a background as a combat veteran, former Army officer, and multi-million dollar mortgage note company owner, Jamie brings a wealth of knowledge and inspiring stories to each episode. Through weekly episodes featuring insightful interviews with industry leaders and solo explorations of mindset and strategy, listeners will uncover actionable advice and tips to overcome challenges and build lasting financial success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, From Adversity to Abundance is your roadmap to turning obstacles into opportunities and achieving financial freedom.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I am your host, Jamie Bateman, and I'm thrilled today to have with us Justin Bogard. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm doing awesome, Jamie. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Justin, you are one of the founders of American Note Buyers, among other things. I know you and I have gotten to know each other a little bit better over the last couple of years, and I'm really excited to dive in here. For the audience out there, for the listener, who are you and why should we listen to you?
Right. So my name is Justin Bogard, as Jamie pointed out. I am a real estate note investor. I co-founded American Note Buyers with my business partner, Richard Thornton. And so I run the operations of the business and we manage a real estate fund.
Awesome. That's cool. So now just obviously you and I are somewhat in the same space, but basically in the same professional space. We have a little bit of a different approach to how we run our businesses. But for the listener out there who's unfamiliar with, you know, mortgage notes are, how that works, what is it that your business actually does in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, so we specialize in what we call mom and pop seller finance notes. We purchase them for the purpose of buying the performing cash flow. And then we end up reselling those notes in volume later after we hold them for a year or two. And that's the purpose for our fund right now.
Awesome. Perfect. I know we're going to come back to that in a little bit and dive into your business and the different types of people you work with and who you serve and that kind of thing. Let's jump into your backstory, Justin. I know you've been through some hard times and obviously this show is called From Adversity to Abundance. And like we briefly mentioned before we hit record, everyone's story is different. And everyone's version of adversity, everyone's, you know, picture of abundance is different, but that's what makes your story unique. And that's why we want to hear about it. So where do you want to start off?
Oh, we can start wherever. I like to when people work with me, with investors that want to invest in our fund or clients that want to purchase notes from us and kind of continue a long-term relationship with them, they kind of want to know the man that I am and the characters that I have. And I always root that back to my sports days growing up. So
yeah,
my dad still is a big sports fanatic. He loves sports. And he grew up with nine other brothers and sisters. So he's a family of 10. His mom was a family of 12. She's part of 12 siblings. So they come from a very big family. So he grew up in the 50s and 60s. So he had to share a bedroom with a brother, one or two of his brothers his whole life until he moved out to college. And then he finally, you know, got to be on his own. So he always was playing sports. He was always doing things. He was very active in general. And, you know, still today, he can't sit still. So when I was growing up, you know, I'm the only boy in the family. I have two older sisters. One's about 8 years older than me. And so I was always in sports, which I wanted to do because, you know, I'm a kid. I want to play baseball. I want to do soccer. I want to do swimming, football, basketball, you know, all that stuff. So my dad would always push me to do that stuff and was always, you know, practicing with me and stuff. So that became a big part of my life. And so as I got better in certain sports I didn't excel in, it happened to be swimming was the best sport that I excelled in. So I ended up doing that kind of year round. And as I got better, I had, you know, different coaches and was pushed in different ways. And that kind of developed me into a very having structured environment. And then also not having time to do anything else. As you know, Jamie, you play lacrosse and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was always driven that way. I ended up being in the Indiana State Finals my senior year for swimming. And so we had a medley relay team and I was in an individuals event, 100-yard breaststroke, excuse me. And so that was kind of my biggest achievement. I ended up going to college because of it, getting a scholarship.
Nice.
To go to college, and I swam in the junior college national championships for 2 years in a row. Qualified for the U.S. Open in the 200-yard breaststroke in 1999.
Wow.
Didn't go to the U.S. Open, but I did qualify for it. I kind of reached the pinnacle of where I could. I actually qualified by 1/100th of a second. So it's just like, you know, the length of the thickness of a hair, you know, is how I would describe it, is how I got that cut.
That's but awesome.
I just, with all the training, those of you that are athletes, you kind of understand what you have to go through with your body mentally.
Definitely.
Mentally, your body physically, obviously, have to go through. So that's kind of where my discipline, my strive, my determination, my never really quit attitude, never give up attitude, derives from that.
No, I love it. And I mean, I come from a big family myself, and we were all athletes. You know, I can relate on many levels. You know, I think team sports and individual sports obviously teach slightly different lessons, but I think there's so much you can draw from sports in general, and just so many life lessons I think are, you know, very applicable. My daughter through her school she has to pick an after school activity and tends to be sports. And I, you know, she's not going to be a professional athlete, most likely, right? That's okay. I think there's so much you can apply from sports. I love it. And like you alluded to, the discipline, not just, I mean, just the structure of, you know, I just think when you're not involved in a sport where you're working toward a goal and training and focused on accomplishing something, people tend to drift and not do as well academically or whatever else. And of course, a lot of these lessons you can learn from other, you know, things outside of sports, but I think sports naturally lend themselves to teach these lessons. So, okay. So you did the junior college swimming thing and, you know, in a very impressive way. And then what happened?
So I ended up doing another year. Junior college is only for 2 years, for those of you that don't know that. And so I did another year at our Indianapolis college, IUPUI, studying for computer science and math. And I ended up not graduating on purpose. Okay. I actually quit college, and I ended up working for a temp agency that kind of put me in a job opportunity for working for a printing company of all places. So I figured out how to use my computer skills to help that company out and ended up being their database manager and IT type of manager. And so I just kind of went from there to another mail company / print company, and then went to another mail / print company and kind of built myself up in middle management. So I got a lot of training and skills on how to be a manager, and then also how to be heavily involved in the data mining of those companies.
Now, why did you choose computer science? Was it you were good at it, or you thought you could find a high paying job, or a combination?
All the above, really. Yeah. At the time, I graduated high school in 1997. So I was in college from, 98 to 2000, 2001. And at the time, the dot-com bubble was out there. And so having an online presence, using computer skills, getting certain programming languages was a big push, because the whole world was starting to really understand that, computer science is really the future. What we need for software and hardware. And so all that stuff interests me, probably more hardware than software. Okay. So I actually ended up doing some electrical engineering classes as well. And so all that stuff kind of interests me. I'm a very hands-on type of person. I don't like to read instructions, surprise, surprise, being a man.
Right.
But I do like to reverse engineer how things work. And I do like to look at a problem and solve it on my own. That challenge is very relaxing to me, if you can say that. Sure. I like that. So like when my mom would buy things for, she had a small beauty salon. So she would buy like certain chairs or certain equipment, and she would ask me to put them together. Like I would just like to put it together. I learned how to work on cars, like by myself, just reading, magazines and books and stuff. And all those things just interest me, being mechanically minded like that. And so that was the computer science part, was obviously a lot less physical work. So it was just, using a keyboard and your mind.
Yeah,
that's really what interests me in computer science.
Makes sense. All right. So, and then why did you quit college? Was it just not going well, or was that more of an intentional decision that you didn't want to go that route?
Both. So I didn't do well in school and in college. I didn't get very good grades. I was probably more or less a C, B student in high school. And in college, I did put forth the best effort that I could with having a full swimming schedule as well. And it was very difficult. Not asking for anybody's pity for that, but it was difficult because I'd never been pushed in school before. So I found out very quickly that I just wasn't built well to take tests and wasn't built well to be in a classroom environment like that per se. So I needed to learn things on my own and be a lot more visual.
So I decided
that I wanted to get into the workforce and use what I know to start getting a job instead of going through school again. It was just, it was like how I describe it, nails on the chalkboard for me to be in school. So I don't say that for anyone listening to not go to school, if anybody young is listening on this podcast. I just say that because it just didn't work for me. It didn't fit me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to push my kids to go to school if they don't want to, as far
as
college.
That was my next question, actually. I know you have kids, and what's your advice to your kids about college?
So my daughters are 9 and 11 right now, and they are, I'm not sure if I told them I didn't finish college or not. I think I might have told the oldest one, but I've already told them that they choose what they want to do as far as what they want to be when they grow up. And it doesn't have to involve college, and it can if you want. But it's not a big push for me, and they know that coming from me and from their mom too.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I think you were just cutting edge. I mean, now it seems like college might be not as necessary. So we'll just say that you were a trendsetter.
Well, I'll just say this, not to digress too much, but specialty seminars are really like master's degree in your craft. Mm-hmm. So what we do, Jamie, if we were to take certain mentorship programs like out of high school or after a few years of college, it would have benefited us greatly to what we are today. We probably could have fast tracked, 8 to 10 years of our life just by going through specialty note training or real estate training out of college or right out of high school, as opposed to going to college just to get, a general education with a specific minor.
For sure. No, I talked before about how I ended up working for a title company, and I realized how little I knew about any of that. What's the settlement statement? What is title insurance? That's a good point. But it's pretty important to understand at least how you know, these transactions work, but certainly not something I learned in school. But so yeah, let's fast forward a little bit. I mean, obviously we're going to hit on some of the adversity. I know what you've talked about is already, you know, we've been through challenges up to, you know, what we've talked about already, but let's kind of focus on some of the more serious adversity that you ended up facing.
So what I talk about so far is not real world problem stuff. It's not even a problem in anyone else's eyes. I was pretty fortunate. I have a mom and dad that worked one to two jobs, and they worked all the time, and they provided for us. And we had a nice home. We always had clothes on our backs, and we always had food in our bellies. So we're very grateful for that opportunity. Mm-hmm. They pushed us in sports. They pushed us in school and stuff. So, you know, that part of it, I definitely no adversity there. Just my own trying to get through life, you know, the sure. normal way. So I ended up getting married probably in my early 30s, I think, to my first wife. And so then we had a kid shortly after that. So obviously, you know, my daughter's 11. So it was about 12 years ago when I first got married, fast forward from today. And so that marriage didn't last very long. I think we were married for about 4 or 5 years. Gotcha. And it was, I thought I married my best friend, and it didn't turn out to be that way. There was a lot of, you know, problems with relationships is not success that I've had. Just as an individual in relationships. So, lo and behold, I find out that, you know, there's a lot of drinking involved. You know, she was drinking a lot, and she ended up cheating on me as well a couple of times. So it was pretty devastating to find that out, because it's just like, you know, you got hit in the face. All of a sudden you're just like, where did this come from? Like, who is this person? Like, yes, you weren't that person yesterday. Like, what's going on? So, you know, we did go through counseling and stuff to try to work through some of our stuff. And that's kind of how all this bled out. So that was about a year and a half to 2 years worth of dealing with this person's, you know, the uncertainty of understanding, like, what's going on with you? Are you okay? You know, why are you doing this? And it was just things that I just didn't notice when I was, when we were together and we got married. And so that was kind of a huge, that's probably been the biggest adversity I had to come over in my life, was just understanding why that happened. And
sure. No, I appreciate you sharing. It's not always, you know, necessarily how you want to spend your days, you know, talk about your divorce and all this, but
I've never openly talked about that over the air. Like, those of you that don't know me, I have my own podcast, and I have my own monthly broadcast that I've done for the past 5 or 6 years. And I don't openly talk about my problems or do anything on Facebook like that, but it affected me in a way that I can't describe unless you've gone through it, because I just started a business.
You had just started a job.
About
so give a us a little months. Bit, you know, we don't have to drill down on the stuff you've already mentioned, but give us a little more context as far as so you had one child together at that point, or
we actually had both of our kids at that point.
Okay. So okay. Got it. Makes sense.
The girls were,
that makes sense.
I think they were 4 years old and 2 years old.
Okay. So you had two girls together, and then, and you had just started a business, you said?
Yeah. So she had went out on her own first and decided to be kind of what I call a print broker. So she would work with different clients that would need printing material done, like, you know, large magazines and stuff like that. And so I kind of helped her with that on the side. And so while she was building her business, I was still working a W-2 job. And then once she had enough money to support, you know, that part of the income, I just wanted to be in real estate. And so I saw all these HGTV people at the time. That's when you know, Property Brothers and Fix and Flipper were very hot, very, very new.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be just like them. And I thought I could do it. And lo and behold, there was a team that came into town that was promoting Tarek and Christina El Moussa at the time.
Okay.
And so I went to that seminar, and then I bought into another seminar, and then led me to another seminar, and you know, paid a bunch of money for that stuff. And then took, just got my, cut my teeth in real estate, I guess, from there. And then I figured out how to do it. I quit my job and just wanted to focus on that full time. And then just my back was against the wall, and I just had to figure it out. So I hadn't gotten divorced or had those issues with my wife just yet at that point, but that's kind of how I started in real estate.
Sure. So, and was as far as your decision, because our listener, you know, may have a W-2, may have a side hustle, may be thinking about quitting, or, you know, at that time, did you get your wife on board with you quitting your W-2? What was that transition like from W-2 to entrepreneur?
It was pretty easy transition. The company that I worked for was very understanding and very supportive for me to try to go out on my own. They knew I was very driven. I was good at what I do. I didn't leave them high and dry by any means. I stayed on for a couple of months to kind of transition out. So I cut back my hours, you know, each month, and each month I would add hours to my real estate business as I was learning and reading more and getting more training and spending more money and figuring this stuff out on my own. So that transition was kind of nice. I'm not saying it was easy. It was just nice because everybody understood from all facets, from my wife to the company that I worked for. So that was a nice positive reinforcement there.
Got it. Yeah. Sounds a little bit like mine. I took my time and I went part-time for 7 years and was building my real estate, you know, business on the side, and then eventually quit in March of last year. But So then the divorce and you know, I say this a lot on the show, but it's a kind of the necessary evil as far as the risk we run with the show, or I run, as far as just glossing over people's pain and adversity. And, you know, I know you mentioned that was a year and a half to 2 years of kind of dealing with that. And that's not, none of that was easy. And I know there was a lot that, you know, we're glossing over, but talk to us about kind of from that, I guess, after that 2 year period was up, or, you know, what happened after the kind of that transition took place?
Well, just everything kind of started falling apart. So I took on not a business partner, but kind of a project construction manager partner, if you will, a non-equity partner.
Okay.
So I would be the expert at financing and finding the deals and just underwriting the project in general with a direction of where we wanted to go with fix and flipping and wholesaling.
Okay.
And the construction manager was someone that I trusted and was my friend, and they were supposed to manage the project, get the people in and get the work done. So we worked pretty well together for the most part, but they just didn't have the same drive and tenacity that I did. So there was a lot of things that were just going a little bit slower paced, and a lot of, you know, a few mistakes that were happening. And it was just constantly like revolving door of contractors coming in and out, as far as like, they didn't do it right. We have to redo their work and pay for more stuff.
What year was this?
This was around 2015, 2016.
Got it. Okay.
So
when you could still find deals.
Yeah, exactly. So we could find deals and start working on them. So I, you know, we do a couple projects at a time, but it didn't too many, because these were my first couple of deals. And so that was like right when the bad stuff started happening with finding out about the adultery and the drinking. I knew about for a year or two, and that wasn't the worst part about it. It was the adultery.
It's
like someone else living a second life and right in front of you, and you don't even know what's happening. It's just like, at first you don't believe it. You're just like, how is that possible? Like I'm around you all the time. Like how physically do you have time to do any of this stuff? You know?
Sure. I imagine it just, it rocks you to your core. I mean, it's just, So what goes through your mind as far as, you know, what's going through your mind at that time as you're progressing through that hard couple of years? What's happening internally and with your mindset?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like I would describe it as, like the steps to alcoholism, like being an alcoholic and going through Alcoholics Anonymous. I would take it to that extent, as far as like at first you're just unaware that this is happening. Mm-hmm. And then you finally have to come to realization that it happened and there's not anything you can do about it, but you need to accept it. And then you need to start figuring out how to go forward. Mm-hmm. But the main thing that I was concerned with was my kids. I'm very close to my kids. I care deeply about my children and I want to be the best father that I can to them. And I am more concerned at this point. I'm siloing my feelings and putting to the side, which isn't a good thing. But I did that because I wanted my kids to be reassured that, you know, daddy's okay, mommy's okay. It's just, we're going to be living in two different houses. You know, that they're very young. They didn't react in a negative way. They just look at it as, oh, this is cool. I'm getting two Christmases now. I'm getting two birthdays now. They're like, oh yeah. Sure. You know, they're spinning the fun out of it, you know, spinning it to the positive.
Yeah.
But so that was kind of my first priority, is how do I take care of them? Second priority, how do I make sure I get money coming in the door?
Sure.
My third priority is how do I accept what happened, and how do I move forward from this, and how do I learn from these challenges? So it wasn't easy at all. You know, you have to go mm-hmm. through counseling and figure out what to do. And then, you know, on top of that, mistakes are happening with being a first time entrepreneur and trying to figure out this real estate game on how to do things and how to trust people and how to vet deals and vet people and just knowing how to run a business. It was, Jamie, I made all the mistakes in the world and I lost a crap ton of money too. I lost $60,000 on one flip.
Wow. That is a lot. I mean, it's a lot when you, I mean, for anyone, right? But especially when you're going through a divorce and I mean,
My mind probably wasn't right. At the time, I thought I was sharp and I knew what I was doing. But before I knew it, people were making mistakes. We were to market too early. I was, you know, I don't know. I don't know what happened. I can look back now and point fingers, but at the end of the day, the person that is the problem is the person that's talking on the microphone right now.
No, I appreciate you being vulnerable and honest. And it's, you know, it's that, that's what I'm trying to get at with this show, is it's easy to think that it's all rainbows and unicorns and Justin Bogard's this entrepreneur who's just got it made and was handed everything. And
no,
it's not like that. And no, I appreciate you sharing. But so what, if looking back on, and I know we haven't finished the rest of the story yet, but just kind of up to that
more.
Point. Yeah, there's more.
There's
but
more.
Up to that well, point with both the family hardships and the business and technically not partnership, but, you know, business hardships or, you know, relationships there. What have you learned at this point? You know, looking back, what did you learn up at that, till that point? Any lessons you could pull out?
Yeah, there's a lot of lessons. You know, at first, as far as a relationship goes, I need to be more open with my feelings. I did need to wear my heart on my sleeve a little bit more. So at least the other person knows where I'm at. The mm-hmm. other person knows my values and how I feel and what I think.
Sure.
And then also I need to make sure that they reciprocate that as well and make sure the communication is a two-way street and not very closed off. And I think that was a big major problem with my first marriage mm-hmm. was that the communication just wasn't open. It was always assumed that the other party was happy because mm-hmm. I didn't know otherwise, but we didn't also talk about it either. So mm-hmm. there isn't blame, 100% blame on her side. You know, there's blame on my side as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I learned from my first marriage is the communication really is the open door. And like what you said, Jamie, no matter what you see on people's Facebook posts, all this happy, you know, rainbows and sunshine stuff, it isn't reality at all.
Right.
It's a facade of what's really going on. Not saying every happy person on Facebook is actually depressed and sad and everything's horrible on their side. It's
just
they're not showing you the full gambit of the picture of the story.
Right.
You're just seeing the highlight reel. Right.
Yeah. And the truth is, and I, you know, I've talked about this with my wife. It's like, you know, people only put their vacation pictures. Yeah. But I kind of like seeing their vacation pictures. Like,
well, I do that too. Yeah.
You know, exactly. I don't want to necessarily always dive into people's problems all day. I'm going on social media to, you know, to have a nice positive break. So we're not saying it's necessarily a bad thing that people are doing that, but just understand that what they're posting is it can get, if you take that as 24/7, this is what their life is always like. That's just not the truth.
Everybody has their own struggles. Everybody has their own life problems and it all sucks, but there's also a positive to it. There's also highs and there's also lows and we all go through it. And I expect that to happen in the future.
Yeah.
And by all means, I feel like I've had, you know, in my experience and walking a mile in my shoes, I've had some hard times. But mm-hmm. but they're not probably anything like somebody else's hard times to where maybe they've lost a loved one or something very, very traumatic has happened to them. I don't want to compare myself to a situation like that, but I have gone through hard times and I know that it's made me stronger and I had to learn from those hard times in order to get back, you know, to the positive direction. So.
Yeah. So on the small business side or the real estate investing side, what was anything was communication also the lesson there, or what was a lesson you could take from that?
It's the real estate, knowing how to flip a house or knowing how to wholesale, it's not that complicated. Mm-hmm. Knowing how to buy a note or invest a note, it's not that complicated. It isn't rocket mm-hmm. science.
Yeah.
But that's one small part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're on your own, you either do this as a part-time thing or you do this as a full-time thing. I chose to do it as a full-time thing. I had only my own money to back me, and I mm-hmm. didn't ask for any help or any money from my family. And I don't know if they would have gave it to me, but I didn't ask for it because I didn't want that. That's not the type of person I am. I don't want a handout. I want to learn mm-hmm. the hard way because I'm hard-headed. So I did that on my own. So when I lost all that money, I was negative. My worth was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars negative.
Mm, wow.
So it was devastating.
So, and at the, just to, with the family side of things, when you were $100,000 to $200,000 negative, whatever it was exactly, but when you were, had no money, what was going on was that as you were going through the divorce, or what was the timing of everything? How did that line up with the family side of things?
Yeah. So when I found out about the adultery stuff, I knew the relationship was over, and that at least that was a known fact going forward. Mm. And that mm-hmm. just going through the divorce, separating the assets and all that stuff was actually easy to do mm. because there was no disagreement from either side on stuff. Mm. We didn't make it, well, I should say I didn't make it difficult for the other person, for my mm-hmm. ex.
Sure.
I just said, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point? I could right. dislike them. I could say I loathe them. I could say I hate them. I could mm-hmm. try to spite them. I could try to put things back in their face and be, you know, passive aggressive. But at the end of the day, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, who really cares? What good is that going to do me by being vindictive? And so that's just not the person that I am. So I just move on. I just be the best co-parent that I can with them. You know,
sure.
to this day, we still communicate pretty well. And there's no like friction or problem between us. I just kind of said what I said, you know, mm-hmm. while we were getting divorced, and it just yeah. is what it is. There's nothing I can do about it to change the past.
So then the business hardships, how did that coincide with the divorce?
It was the perfect storm. It all gotcha. Happened kind of at the same time. And there's a saying that you hear, when it rains, it pours. And mm-hmm. I relate to that in a lot of times in my life. I know mm-hmm. when something bad happens and a couple other things bad happen, like the rest of it's going to come down. So just expect it to come down. So it doesn't seem yeah. that bad, right? You know what's going to happen.
Sure.
If you know someone's yeah. going to rip off the Band-Aid, at least you know, as opposed to being surprised about it.
Yeah.
Take it a little better.
I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to our mutual friend, Chris Seveny's episode on my show. It was episode 3. So we're going back about a year, but
yeah.
He went through, there was a 2 or 3 month period where it was a divorce and about $250,000 in debt, if I recall correctly. And then he also had a major health scare. Yeah. And so again, you get into this comparison game, and that's not the point. It's just, in a lot of ways, you know, he went through a similar type story where, just like you said, when it rains, it pours. And he ended up moving geographically and kind of restarting. So how did you refocus? How did you rebuild at that point?
What's kind of the same way you described Chris's story. That's kind of how I think. I just, like a computer, I just want to reboot. Yeah. I want to push a button, just said reset. Okay.
Sure.
Wipe the memory clean. You don't, nothing happened in the past. I'm like a goldfish, right? Got 10-second memory, Ted Lasso, right?
Right.
10-second memory. Nice. And just reset and move forward. You can express your emotions and express your feelings is what I've learned. And it's okay to do that. And you should do that. But at the same time, you just need to acknowledge your feelings and you need to move forward. And so I lost a bunch of money, you know, whoop-de-doo, poor Justin, right? But how do you get it back? How do you move forward? How do you not make that mistake again? Are you going to just give up because you lost a bunch of money? Has anyone mm-hmm. else done that? Well, yeah, lots of people have lost money before. Lots of people
sure.
made mistakes. And I know that I don't want to go back to a W-2 job. I just consider that jail for me. I don't want to go to jail.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it. There's been sure. many times, and I've lost money again on deals, not too far from the timeline where we're at right now, and mm-hmm. where I lost it all again. Right. Mm. I get it back and I lost it all again. I refuse to give up this life of being an entrepreneur and being a business owner. And I won't back down no matter how many times I get knocked down.
I love it. That's great. So just looking back on the times you've lost money as in specific deals, and I think you would agree it's almost unavoidable if you do enough deals. And you know, yeah. you can't approach business or investing with from the standpoint of there's no risk or anything like that. There's always risk. But what would you do differently from maybe an individual deal standpoint, or how have you adjusted your business model, going forward to avoid a big loss like that?
Well, I feel really comfortable now when I look at a deal and I underwrite it, because I know the expenses in my head now that I've experienced going through a deal forwards and backwards and doing it many times. Mm-hmm. So I understand what it costs to go into it. I understand what can go wrong, and I know what's going to happen. I hate not knowing what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And so because now I know what's going to happen, anything minor that pops up really isn't a big deal. I know it's not mm-hmm. a major thing. So sure. Going forward, I definitely have a lot of experience. And then I also have people that I can lean on very heavily. I have you, I have Chris, yeah. I have Richard, I have my mentors that got me into the note business.
Yeah.
I have all those people I can lean on when I have those challenges. So I would, and until this point, I don't have to lean on people too often anymore unless I come across a really unique situation that I just don't know. Mm-hmm. But I have sure. that luxury today of passing on that knowledge now to the next person. And so that's,
I love it.
A lot of what we do today is more, not training per se, but more just educational mm-hmm. to say, hey, learn from our experiences. And
sure.
We can tell you when you're doing this type of deal, I pretty much know what's going to happen with this deal. You know, I can mm-hmm. know what this borrower is thinking. I know they're lying. I know, right. I know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. It's yeah. And you get sometimes these, cause there's so many coaches and trainers out there now, sometimes those of us who do this in any capacity, because I do mentorship, on a one-on-one basis as well. And it's some of us get a bad rap because, because there are some shady coaches
out there. There's some bad actors out there, that's for sure.
For sure. And, people who just should not be advising others, for sure. But you reach a point where it's like, well, why would you not, if you have all this experience, why would you not give back? Why, and there's value in that for other people. So they should be paying you for that. If, that's a good thing. But question on the, so you mentioned your business partner, Richard. How did you get comfortable enough to partnering with Richard? And what do you look for when you're working with people professionally at this point?
Yes. Yeah, so again, it's like losing money on a deal and then trying to pick up the pieces and move forward. It's the same thing with a business partner or someone that you want to work with on a team. Mm-hmm. You're going to go through people. You're going to go through employees. It's just until you find the right assistant, virtual assistant or helper, mm-hmm. you're not going to find the right one until you do. And so you may go through several, and just like vendors, you're going to go through several vendors or contractors until you find the right one that works for you. So it's sniffing out what is it that I'm looking for? And then how does that person replicate that? Or how do they complement what I do well?
Sure.
So I know what I do well. I know what Richard Thornton does well.
Yeah.
And so together we have a business marriage. Very well, because there are things that he does that I just don't want to do and I don't do well to begin with. There's mm-hmm. things that I do really well that he just, throws up his hand and says, that's not me. Right. I don't want to do it.
Yeah. Right. No, and like I said, I've gotten to know you guys a little bit better and it seems like you work very well together. So before I jump, I do have some more rapid fire questions, but before I get to those, what's, talk about your business today. What does that look like? You have a fund. What does that mean? What's your business look like today?
Yeah. So today, we're doing the same thing that we're doing the past 6 or 7 years, which is just buying seller finance paper. We find the people that create seller financing or do owner financing on their properties, and then we buy that paper from them. And so with the fund, now we have a bigger bank that we can work from instead of using our own capital, because Richard and I decided, hey, let's use our own money. And then we realized after, you know, 10, 14 deals, we don't have any more money. So how do we get more money there? Well, we should be doing a fund. We didn't know we were going to have this much opportunity to buy stuff. We didn't know we were going to do this well, this quickly. And so we just said, stop. We need a solution quickly. And we said, let's start a fund. So we said, we're going to do a $10 million fund. We're doing a family and friends fund.
Yeah.
We call it 506B, fully regulated, and you know, had an attorney draft all the paperwork.
Sure.
And so we have investors now that are investing in our fund, where it's going to be a 10-year fund. And we only have, we're planning on after the first couple of years to do the next iteration of that fund to make it larger and more robust. And so that's kind of our game plan. Our stepping stone is to get to three funds. And so the first one is already in place in motion and already active. And the second one, about 2 years from now, we'll probably introduce the second.
Nice. Well, I mean, a couple things I'll add on. One is you have the real estate background from, you know, fix and flipping and wholesaling and construction. And I mean, that only helps because we do see, you know, as you know, you can be successful as a note investor coming from the engineering side of things or coming from finance or the mortgage side of things, or coming from the real estate or real estate investing niche. It's kind of there's not a one size fits all avatar of who's going to be successful in as a mortgage note investor. But personally, I think if I had to give any, I mean, I think just having that real estate background is huge, because what happens if your borrower goes non-performing, they stop paying? Well, you can evaluate that property, what to do with it, and you have that experience. So I think that only helps. Secondly, I think it just makes sense as far as the fund. I mean, this business comes down to three things. It's raising, it's finding deals, which it sounds like you and Richard have a pretty good niche as far as finding, you know, access to notes themselves, seller finance paper. And the other piece is managing those assets, which I know you do a good job of, because we have used the same platform, and you and I have talked about that. And then thirdly, like you said, it doesn't matter if you and Richard have $10 million between the two of you, you're going to run out of your own capital if you're scaling. I mean, it doesn't really matter. So you've got to find access to capital. So it sounds like you've found a way to solve all three of those problems. I know it's always a work in progress.
I wouldn't say solve the problem, but I'd say
address, work on.
Well, we're definitely trending in the right direction. That, you know, OPM, other people's money, is a key to anybody's real estate business.
Absolutely. No, that makes sense. So, and then you have an educational side, and I know you have, we'll talk in a little bit about how people can reach out to you. But I've got a few rapid fire questions here for you. What's one thing that people misunderstand about you?
Wow. That's a good one. I think it's my discipline and my tenacity. I think that's part of it. The other thing I think people, and I don't know this is just my assumption, just my view on how other people might view me or not take advantage of what I know and my experience, is that I don't feel like a lot of people listen to my advice. And I wish that they would at least consider it, or at least seriously think about the fact that I've been through that before, or I can sense what's going on with this, or, you know, you should do things this way. And it kind of bothers me a little bit, but I'm just, you know, I understand from their point of view, you know, who am I? They don't know me yet, right? They don't know my story or my background. Maybe after this episode, they will.
Yeah, there you go. we're going to fix that problem right here, right now.
That's the biggest thing I noticed, is that I don't think people follow my advice very well. I feel like I give really good advice, Jamie, and I don't charge for it.
Maybe that's the problem. You got to charge for it.
The problem.
No, that's good. I mean, I can relate on some level, but, you know, a lot of times it's just timing and how the message is structured, but it's, you know, you can't force it. What's one of your biggest, you know, regrets or failures that we haven't talked about? Anything that you can point to that you'd like a do-over with?
Man, there's a lot of things I'd like a do-over with. But at the same time, I'll talk out the other side of my mouth and say I wouldn't be here and know what I know today if I didn't go through what I went through.
Sure.
Going through the divorce, losing a lot of money, not knowing if I'm going to be able to afford to buy my kids food. It's just, there was times in my life to where it's just like, my God, like, is it really this bleak? And then I would read about, you know, other entrepreneurs and other CEOs. It's like, they all go through it. They all lost money. They've all gone through terrible stuff, very stressful things. Like, if you can't stomach this stuff, don't be an entrepreneur. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
I didn't know the stuff either. I wish I would have had better mentorship or known who to trust early on. And I think I would have had a lot less struggles. I still would have struggled. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
This wouldn't have been, there is no perfect road. There is no perfect way to hold somebody's hand. It's just, it's too difficult to teach being a business owner in a class. You just have to get your hands dirty and just,
absolutely,
just hope and pray.
Yeah, there's some principles you can, you know, fall back on, but your business looks different than my business, so we might have different struggles. And so speaking of that, though, if you could go back and give your 18-year-old self some advice, what would it be?
I would say understand money, understand financing very quickly.
Yeah, I love that. It's really good. Yeah, that's a tough one too, because it's you know, we say we should educate. And I fully agree. It's critical, right, to educate the younger generation on personal finance and investing. Getting their buy-in is the hard part sometimes, but I'll just leave that there. If you could go back and have a coffee or a drink, or, you know, have a conversation with any historical figure, who would you choose?
Any historical figure? Oh my gosh.
They could still be alive today. It's just anybody you'd like to, you know, pick their brain for half an hour.
Man, I mean, nothing jumps out on paper, but I would probably pick somebody that has just been through just a lot of life challenges and just understand where their mind was, where they were going through, how they move forward. Like I said, I can't picture who that would be off the top of my head, but it would be someone, and it may not be somebody famous. It may be somebody close to me that I know that I would look up to and be like, I want to be like that person.
Absolutely. If you were given $10 million tomorrow, what would you do with it?
Invest in a fund. I would definitely not spend it. I would probably pay off some debt that's been bothering me. And then I would probably make sure that I set up a very strong portfolio that would just keep constant cash flow coming in.
Nice.
And build off that. I always try to live beneath my means, or just right at my means, and not overspend. So I don't have fancy stuff, because I just want to set up for the future. I'm used to not having fancy things, so I don't want to start having it and be spoiled.
Yeah, absolutely. How about a book that you could recommend, a book or two that's either in, you know, about life or entrepreneurship or investing, any of those topics? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, there's a few books that I've read. The titles are escaping me. And obviously, Rich Dad, Poor Dad is probably the number one book that you just have to read when you get into real estate. Just, it does a great job of setting the table of understanding why 9 out of 10 millionaires are in real estate, to understanding financials, understanding about hard assets, and understanding leveraging. Like, all those techniques are a great precursor to what you can be. But I also read a lot of just... sometimes I read just odd books that have nothing to do with life, nothing to do with bettering yourself as far as being a business person.
Sure.
So I sometimes read some occult or esoteric type of books just for the story of it, or just understanding that this might have happened in our past. And that kind of, I'll say excites, but I guess it answers a lot of questions for me about, you know, how did we get fast forward to 2023 from, you know, year zero when Christ was born? Like, what, how do we get to here, you know, and how are things moving slow? And then all of a sudden there was a explosion of, you know, industrialism and stuff. So it's just, that stuff fascinates me just to understand.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it sounds like you have that analytical mind and you like to deconstruct things and just kind of understand things from that standpoint. So what's one thing in your business that you, a problem that you're dealing with right now on the business side?
The biggest problem that we have, I think, is very similar to any business today, and that's knowing how to market. So knowing how to market, meaning we have to, like you said, we have to raise capital. So we're looking for individuals with private money. Number two, we have to find inventory. So that's two of our legs, of our three-leg stance here.
Yeah.
And so marketing to those two different verticals is always a challenge, because it's an ever-moving target. And it isn't the old ways before a lot of social media and technology, where you just send out mail or put things in the newspaper because everyone is reading those things. Well, now everyone's reading a multitude of different type of sources. Mm-hmm. And it's how do you spend your money and where you spend your money. So it's very difficult to figure out, like you said in the beginning, your avatar of who your customer is or who your client is, and understanding them and how to reach them in a way that makes sense, so that they are, you know, enticed, or at least this is what they want to do. And I just happen to be in front of them when they want to make that decision.
Sure. No, I can totally understand. It's the passive investor is very different than the active note investor, real estate investor. And, you know, how do you focus your marketing and business development efforts to kind of provide the most value to the person you're trying to reach?
Well, there's sales, there's marketing, and they're not the same thing.
They're not the same thing. Yep, this is true. I've just started trying to implement some KPIs. We just starting this in my business, you know, because we do all this marketing, and it's like, what for? Posting on social media, that's cool. Like, you know, it doesn't really mean anything unless it's really coming back to the business. But what's one question that I haven't asked you that you wish I had? Anything you want to talk about that we haven't touched on? Talk about your podcast and where people can find you.
So we have a podcast called Be the Bank. We are on season 5, and we're through probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes already on season 5. We release it every other Wednesday. So we do about 26 episodes a year. So every year is a season. That's how I'm keeping track. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to keep track. I've been doing this for 5 years. I started off with my good friend here locally in the Indianapolis area. Her name is Elizabeth Mayora, or she likes to be called Super E. So we had the Super E and J podcast, and that was kind of the pilot season, the first season. And then we changed the iteration to the Two Wealth Show, because we're just talking about wealth and
she was she's into short-term rentals. Is that right?
She is. She's our short-term rental expert in our in our region, really. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of people that do it. So she kind of flourished pretty quickly. And she does. Mm-hmm. She's really smart, really well. She worked in the car industry up in Michigan for a while in corporate. And so then she decided that she just really doesn't have a lot of time for it. Things are going well for her. She's running other businesses and buying other businesses. And so then I just took the lead and said, you know what? Don't worry about it. I got this. And then I started the Be the Bank podcast. So now I've done 2 seasons of this new iteration of it.
Yeah.
And so we focus on just talking about, it's almost like back to sports now. The ESPN analyst the next day talking about the game last night. You know, it's just Richard and I, or me and a guest, bringing up maybe a specific topic or just analyzing something and just having debate and discussion about it and just being open about it. It's very quick. It's 20 to 30 minutes. So it's a car ride. That's what that podcast does. So it's called Be the Bank. You can subscribe to it on any podcast directory. And then we do a live monthly educational broadcast that we do on our YouTube channel and our Facebook page. And that's American Note Buyers YouTube channel. And that is basically informational, more visual, just showing about maybe stats going on in the industry. We'll usually show a case study or give an example of things that we've done. So it helps people kind of understand real estate, so they can choose to do it on their own, but most likely they end up being more passive and want to invest in like a fund.
Sure. Makes a lot of sense. Where do you see things going on the seller financing side of things?
It's been trending. Let's start back to the crisis of 2009, the debacle, the real estate debacle, I'll call it, the recession, whatever, the Great Recession, I think is what they called it. They labeled it as the states did. So mortgages immediately got underwater because prices of home values just dipped very quickly, pretty much overnight. So banks foreclosed like crazy. In around 2012, 2011, 2013, there was just a floodgate of foreclosures coming through. And you could have all the money in the world and spend as much as you can at the sheriff's sale, and there'd still be leftover inventory. It was just it was that much inventory that came to fruition. So a lot of these hedge funds would gobble them up. They would buy them. They would resell them on seller financing and do nothing to them. And borrowers would put down payments, and they would sell them on land contract or contract for deeds or sometimes note mortgages. So that paper kind of baked 2014, 2015, 2016. They started selling off that paper a little bit at a time. So we had a lot of paper like that that came through. At that time, real estate was just, you know, rising in appreciation around 2018. It kind of staved off. And then so that's when kind of things got flat, and it was harder to do. Noticing starting to do harder to do flips and stuff until we got 2020. And then really since the credit crunch was happening in 19, 20, 21, it's been harder for people to get bank financing. So now seller financing becomes strong. Appreciation is still rising. It's still rising like crazy. So seller financing is going to continue to get stronger for the next couple of years. So if you don't know this already, Jamie, it's about 30 to 35,000 seller finance transactions get recorded every year. Residential, commercial, land, all that stuff. Bulk of them come from Texas.
No, I agree that it's only going to continue to trend in the upward direction as far as opportunity in the seller finance, seller financing space. You know, it's, and of course we record this, you know, today, who knows what it's going to be like in 6 months, right? We don't have a crystal ball, but the fact is, like you said, residential real estate can, even though there are other offices, you know, commercial is different. Multifamily might start to see some real, it's looking like we're seeing some cracks in that, that space. But when you're talking residential real estate in the, say, $75,000 to $250,000 range, it's only, the prices are only continuing to climb. And because why would people, transactions are down, but, so that collateral value is only continuing to rise. And like you said, and with the credit crunch, underwriting standards have only gone up and up and up. So it's hard to get an institutional loan. It's hard to get a loan from a bank. Right.
Well, why would they lend on a property that's $150,000 less? It's just, it does them no good because it costs them the same to underwrite that as it does a $1 million home. So why would they want to? It only benefits us as entrepreneurs and real estate investors for seller, to do seller financing, to help that market void right there, as our friend Eddie would say.
Absolutely. So no, that's great. It seems like you've got some strong opportunity there in the space that you find yourself in.
Yeah. Residential is going to be good. I think 2024 in the spring is going to be a great year to start investing in real property again. I think you'll start to seeing more motivated sellers at that point. And so I think there'll be, the inventory will start to balance back out again. I think commercial is going to be a great opportunity for non-performing note investors. It's only going to get more bleak for the commercial banks and commercial lending right now, because they're holding paper that's just losing its value every day. And so you can you're probably going to be able to pick up some pretty good deals pretty soon if you invest in commercial. It's a lot more capital intensive, but you can pick up some good deals, which is great while we have the fund as well. And you do too.
Absolutely. There's always opportunity behind every problem, right? Even though the headlines will scare you. That's the life of an entrepreneur and an investor, is finding that opportunity and then adding value to those distressed assets and adding value to your investors and the people you work with. So, what else do you want to add, Justin, before we wrap up?
I appreciate being on. This is the first time I shared a lot of those things on open air. So hopefully my experiences will give somebody inspiration to say, you know, there's somebody has gone through something. Like I said, some of my stuff is not traumatic or tragic by any means from somebody else's experiences or what they've gone through. But I think the moral of my story can relate to a lot of people is, you know, if you want to do this, just commit to it, just like a marriage, and just be in it for the long haul. And there's going to be ups, there's going to be a lot of downs. And all you have to do is learn from the downs and be prepared for when they happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very practical episode. Unfortunately, a lot of people can relate to relationship struggles and you know, adultery and divorce and things like that. You know, and I just love the fact that you were vulnerable and that, you know, you recognized, even though a lot of what you went through, you actually couldn't control, you're still owning up to, you know, there are lessons there for what you could have done better as far as the communication. You talked about that. Yeah. And so just for, I think for the listener out there, understanding that life sucks sometimes and that's okay. And you can get through it and better days are ahead. And you know, you, Justin, you've had struggles on the personal side of things as well as on the, you know, the business side of things, but you're still here and, your lessons from your sports and your swimming, your discipline and your tenacity that came out of that is only going to come back and reward you and reward, you know, Richard and the investors who work with you. So I do thank you for coming on and, any last tidbit you want to share?
Yeah, I would say as you were, regurgitating this episode here and spelling it out in a fast sense, I was thinking, one of the best things that I learned from counseling is that when you get stuck on something or you just shake your head and you don't understand why, you know, you write down on a piece of paper, what are the things I can control? Mm. And what are the things I can't control? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I can't control is somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. I can control my feelings. I can control how I react to a situation, but I can't control what somebody else does.
Sure.
So a lot of the things that I do in life, I sit back and I just understand, like, if I'm trying to get a certain reaction out of somebody or a certain thing to happen, I need to make sure that I'm communicating to them how they want to be communicated. So one of my biggest pet peeves is people not reading emails. So I understand when you send a lengthy email, not everybody is going to read it in its entirety. So you have to make it very brief, very quick, and very easy to follow, color coordinate it, bullet point it, and just say, I need these three questions answered. And then, you know, your life's a lot easier. So I can't control if somebody reads my emails,
right?
But I can control is just getting the point out quickly.
Yeah. How you present that email to them. You and I have several of the same pet peeves.
Yeah.
Why won't this person listen to me? You know, why won't they read my email?
I mean, I told you to use the blue pen on the white paper. Right. Hello. I don't know how else to spin it.
But that's good. No, it's very true though. In all seriousness, you can't control what other people, anything they can't do really.
So why get upset about it, Jamie?
Yeah.
Why get upset about it?
Yep. I love it. Well, Justin Bogard, this has been very good. I really appreciate your time. I think Welcome. You said you said something about you're about to go swing some golf clubs. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a nice day today. I'm going to hit the range real quick. And then
awesome.
My youngest daughter has a math bowl contest at our local middle school in a few hours. So that's
love it.
That's my plans today. And that's what I look forward to is just getting to enjoy those things because I have those freedoms now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you mentioned your podcast and your monthly webinar show. What is there anything else you want to put out there as far as how the listener can get a hold of you?
Sure, I appreciate that opportunity to plug in. So once again, we're with American Note Buyers. We have a website called anbfunds.com. We have a podcast that's called Be the Bank. You can subscribe to any podcast directory. We have a YouTube channel for American Note Buyers. You can look us up and see tons of videos. And so those are the three things that we have out there. So if you want to communicate with us, go to our website, anbfunds.com. And we have a awesome. Contest Us page, and you can just kind of look at some of our content there. But if you're wanting to get some free stuff out of it, listen to our podcast, download it, and then also watch some of our YouTube videos. We have a ton of content out there, just, you know, like I'm sure you and Chris do as well.
Yeah. No, and like I said, for the listener out there, I've gotten to know Justin and Richard better over the last year or two, and I highly recommend you check out their content. They know what they're doing. They put out a lot of good stuff. So thanks again, Justin. And to the listener, thank you for spending your most valuable resource with us. And that is your time. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
All right, here's the deal. You work hard for your money. Isn't it about time you put your money to work for you? If you are an accredited investor, check out LabradorLending.com. Our Integrity Income Fund provides monthly cash flow from an investment backed by hard physical real estate. Our income fund, which is uncorrelated to publicly traded stocks and bonds, invests in first lien mortgage notes diversified by geography, property value, and borrower type. So you're not investing in one project. You're investing in a diversified portfolio of first lien mortgage notes. Our Integrity Income Fund aims to pay its investors monthly distributions at a preferred rate of return of 8% annually. Possibly the best part, though, the fund showcases a short 12-month commitment. So you can invest your capital today and have access to that capital in 1 year. Check it out today, LabradorLending.com.